Hello and welcome to the Inheritance Podcast. I'm Joe Riley, and I've always been interested in what people do with their money and what that money does to them. Today, in conjunction with the James E. Hughes Jr. Foundation, I'd like to present my interview with one of Jay's longtime collaborators, John A. Warnick. John A., as he is known, is the founder of the Purposeful Planning Institute, which trains lawyers, financial planners, trustees, and wealth managers to work with clients on their planning that is congruent with their core values and vision. He was a longtime trust and estates lawyer himself in Colorado with the firms Holm, Roberts, and Owen, where he chaired the Private Clients Services Group. He left the firm and began collaborating with Jay Hughes and Tim Belber and began to focus on ensuring that the affluence of his clients was a positive force in the lives of their following generations. John A. received his bachelor's magna cum laude from Brigham Young University and his JD from George Washington University with honors. Please enjoy my conversation with John A. Warnick.
This podcast is for educational and entertainment purposes only. Anything said by the guests or host should not be construed as legal or investment advice. Thanks for listening.
Did you always want to be a lawyer?
Great question. It really started, the idea was born, I started out wanting to be a veterinarian. My dad was a professor of reproductive physiology in the animal science department at the University of Florida. So I thought, he hauled me around to ranches all over Florida. And I thought, I think I'd enjoy being a veterinarian. But then when I was 12, Joe, he had a two-year sabbatical from the university and signed a contract with the United Nations. And they took our family to Argentina, where my dad taught veterinarians and people in the kind of the livestock industry there. And so that reinforced this idea that I would be a veterinarian. But then we come back, and part of the gig was the UN assured my parents that they would not be subject to U.S. tax while they were overseas. And not that it was a large amount. I look back and I go, I can't believe that this tempest in the teapot was created over what was today would seem like an inconsequential amount of foreign earnings. But there was a tax court case. So when I was 15, I was deposed in this tax court case, and the lawyer that came down from Washington, D.C. to interview me and take this deposition, in a sense, his name was Angelo Iadarola. And oh my gosh, he was a impressive guy. And seeing him at work, and I just got fascinated with tax law and tax lawyers. And that's when, at age 15, 16, the idea of becoming a tax lawyer came into my head. And I was true to that, went to law school, and I had always wanted to go to law school in D.C. because of Angelo Iadarola, and I did just that, and I became a tax lawyer.
And what did you study as an undergraduate?
Pretty traditional, poli-sci with an econ minor.
Okay, and did you do a thesis?
I did a paper, kind of a senior paper in the political science department on the Denver desegregation case. And that resulted in my getting an internship in the U.S. Supreme Court, not a clerkship, but they had a program at that time. I don't know if they still do, that they took three or four interns every academic semester. And we worked in the office of the administrative assistant to the Chief Justice. And we were basically speech writers, researchers, and observers. And so I did that just before I started law school. That was a pretty heady experience.
Did you ever have any interest in politics or working for the government?
The 5 years we were in D.C., I worked on Capitol Hill. And at that time, definitely, I thought I was headed in that direction. But I have to say that there's this wisdom about working in D.C. If you told me fever. If you stay inside the Beltway more than 5 years, you're going to be there for the rest of your life. And so
right.
It's not that we were aware of that, but we escaped. We left after 5 years. And once I got out into the real world, two things had happened. One was I'd grown disillusioned with the political world. I was pretty idealistic when I first started working on Capitol Hill, and I worked. Yep.
What period was this?
So this was started working on Capitol Hill in the fall of 73.
Okay.
And worked through the summer of 78. I worked for two different congressmen. One, the second guy I worked for, I was incredibly impressed by his kind of ethics, and he was there for the right reasons. And before it became popular, he had campaigned on I won't serve more than 6 terms in the House. And he honored that. He went back, became a university president, and has left politics almost completely. The other guy eventually ran for governor in the state of Florida. He was more the traditional politician, but I really lost my enthusiasm for politics. And when I see where we are today, I go, oh my gosh, I'm so grateful I didn't get into that kind of mess.
Now, it wasn't because of Watergate.
No, I'd say two big things have happened. One is I saw the kind of seamy side of, particularly with the first congressman, he served on the Ways and Means Committee. And so in our office, we had a constant stream of executives from major corporations in America. And this congressman did extremely well fundraising, you can imagine. So I got to see there how legislation is bought, so to speak, rather than is arrived at in a more pristine way. But the other thing that I think turned me off was the incredibly divisive nature, how political extremes have become so predominant, and we have lost the art of coalition and compromise. And I think one of these two congressmen was a Greek American, and he was as conservative, like the ratings, he would be a 98 to a 99 on a 100 scale. But his best friend in Congress was Paul Tsongas from Massachusetts, who was a 98 or a 99 on the ADA, the liberal progressive scale. And yet these two guys, what united them was they were both Greek Americans. So they were working on Greek issues, but they were best friends and they were on political opposite of each other. And I just don't think that really exists today like I saw it. And Tip O'Neill, to his credit, he worked with Republicans. Instead of, they would say some negative things at times, but I just am so disappointed with where we are in politics today.
So what was it like working with families when you started?
I really have kind of two chapters in my career as a tax lawyer. The earliest chapter, I went to work out of law school for what today would be called a tax boutique firm. I was the 7th tax attorney in this firm, and we had offices in Reno and Las Vegas. And we served basically high net worth, high earnings individuals. They were athletes, entertainers, some doctors, some business people. That period of my life was very much driven by income tax. And I really, after about 5 years of a steady diet of tax shelters and tax court litigation, tax controversy work, I realized, Joe, that I was, as the youngest lawyer, I was the one that when one of these doctors or an entertainer would need an estate plan, I would be the one that would be the drafter. And I realized about 5 years into practice that what really drove me and gave me the most satisfaction was conversations with individuals around their families and trying to think about the good that they could do in terms of launching their families. That really invigorated me, excited me. So and this was in the 1980s, I moved at an ever-increasing pace away from income tax into the estate and gift, the wealth transfer planning side of the law. And as I did, things shifted dramatically. And then after I'd been in practice for about 20 years, out of the blue, I was minding my business when a big firm in Denver contacted me. They had been referred to me because of I'd written a tax management portfolio on a somewhat obscure, narrow tax estate planning topic. And so they got in touch with me to help them work on a project with one of their clients. And that led to my coming down to Denver and spending a day in a family office in Cherry Creek. And then after we had this meeting and the family office people and the two lawyers from this big law firm adjourned the meeting, one, the senior of those two lawyers said, "Would you do lunch with me? I'd like to hear about your practice." And I didn't realize it was a job interview, but that's really what it was. And then that led to a courtship romance of about 6 or 8 weeks when they were trying to convince me to leave. So the Nevada firm I started with had sent me to Wyoming. And then when I broke off from that firm, I had a tax practice. I was one of the only tax lawyers in Wyoming. It's pretty easy to build a practice in a hurry in that situation. And now I came from down to Denver from Casper, Wyoming, and they wanted me to leave Wyoming. Wyoming was a pretty nice lifestyle, and I wasn't sure I wanted to move to smoggy Denver. But after about 6 or 8 weeks, I made the decision to go. And it was that was the life altering kind of change of my professional trajectory. I went from a very good practice with kind of ordinarily wealthy people to now working with people at the family office level. And that's really what our, in this big law firm, we did practically nothing but work through family offices. That's, Joe, where there's a story I want to share about how I met Jay, but it was through that law firm and one of the clients that I met Jay. And once I met Jay, everything changed.
We'll talk about that in a minute, but you once said service to a wealthy family is a lonely profession. What did you mean by that?
I think when you're invited inside that circle of trust, begin to serve a wealthy family, you oftentimes have to take on the burdens of the family, and you see a lot of negative emotional things going on, and there really isn't anybody for you to talk to about that. You just have to bear it, and you have to grin, and you have to do the best you can to support and help the family. And the confidence is the privacy, the loyalty demands that we remain very cloistered. And that's what I meant by lonely. One of the great things that came through the association with Jay is I observed Jay creating, I think intentionally, these pockets of contacts that he would bring together in trusted, confidential, private settings where people could talk about things in the cone of confidentiality moment and could unbear their burdens, share what they were seeing that was troubling them, get inspiration from others, and then go back out. And that was so healthy. And that really, because of what I saw with Jay, ultimately was the inspiration that led to forming PPI. I wanted to create, in a sense, something similar to that, that professionals who are in this kind of lonely space could recharge, rejuvenate, get the support emotionally to know that they're not alone in the work and that what they're encountering isn't unique. It may be slightly different than what others are seeing, but there's so many similarities, and the situations that we run into, we can help each other learn, understand how this person dealt with this, and maybe I can learn from that rather than just having to invent something out of whole cloth.
How did you meet Jay Hughes, and how did he change the way you looked at your work?
Thank you for asking. I think it was early spring 2001, thereabouts. A client, when I came into the large law firm, and today the firm that I was in has been gobbled up and is part of the Brian Cave Layton International, a firm of 2,700 lawyers or whatever it is today. But at that time, we were a firm of about 270, so one-tenth the size. And one of the partners had taken a sabbatical and, with the firm's blessing, for 6 months went to Boston and studied the Boston kind of law firm, private trust company model. And before he left, I sat down with him. And since I was a new partner and didn't have as full a book as some of the other more senior partners, he gave me 10 significant client relationships that he wanted me to handle while he was gone. One of those 10, I got to know, struck it off well. And when my partner returned, I continued to be the primary attorney for this family. And one day this gentleman calls me up and says, I'm sending you a book. I'd like you to read it within the next 10 days or so and get back to me and tell me what you think. The book arrived. I opened it up on a Friday, took it home and began reading it on a Saturday. I read it nonstop, was into this book. And the book was, as you might imagine, Family Wealth Keeping in the Family, the little green paperback version. And I couldn't wait until Monday. I called the client back and I said, my gosh, I thank you for sharing this book with me. This, I've learned more about the issues that we're facing in your family reading this book than anything I've read up until now. And he says, I'm glad you, that's how it struck you. I had the same impression. I want you to find this man and hire him as a consultant to our family. And this guy had the means to hire Jay. But I didn't realize how difficult it would be to find Jay Hughes. That book was self-published. And I gave it to law librarians and said, I need the contact information for this man. They came back to me within 2 days and said, we've tried every which way. We even called the old law firm that he was a part of, Jones Day, and they refused to give us any contact information for him. It's a dry road. He's no longer registered with the bar that we can tell. We just self-published book, but can't find the guy. And so I called the client back somewhat disappointed and reported that and gave him the offer. The librarian said that they would call every James Hughes in the New York City phone book to see if they could find the man. And he said, no, I'm reading another book. I think it's even better. I said, what is it? He says, Seven Habits for, and I said, highly effective individuals. He said, no, highly effective families. I said, I didn't realize Covey had written a book for families. He said, yes, it's actually more grounded than that other book I had you read. And I said, I get it. I actually know Covey's estate planning attorney. He says, good, call him. I want to hire Covey then. If I can't get this other guy, let's hire Covey. I was about to put that call into my friend in Orem, Utah, Doug Morrison, and I walked into the partner who had gone to Boston, and I had a little conference with him for about 15 minutes on a matter we were working on together. I left his office, and I took 3 steps down the hall back to the elevator bank, and I ran into Joe, a wall of impression. The impression was, turn around and ask him if he knows James E. Hughes Jr. And I thought, this is crazy. But I did just that. I knocked on Judd's door. Yes, Judd, I know I took a lot of your time, but by any chance, do you know a lawyer in New York City by the name of James E. Hughes Jr.? And he swivels around in his chair. I lose sight of him. And when he comes around, he's holding the little green book. And he says, you mean Jay Hughes? I said, Jay Hughes? He says, that's what friends and family call him. I said, this guy? He says, our firm represents his significant other. you got to be kidding me. You can give me his contact information. He says, I'm not going to give you their home number in Aspen, but I will give you his private secretary's number in New York. I said, okay. The next day I'm on the phone with Andy Andrea, and two or three days later, Jay's calling me from the Paris airport. And we arranged a meeting in the Denver, near the Denver airport, on his way back to Aspen from Europe. And he met my clients and we retained him, and the rest is history. He served for 5 years with that family, and I carried his briefcase, and I will never be the same.
How did your client get the book in the first place?
That's another great question. He got it from, this goes back to the legacy companies, Joe, the Fithians. Scott Fithian and his brother Todd founded a company in Boston called the Legacy Companies. And they were a very small, exclusive network of high-end financial advisors. And they were always on the cutting edge. And they had given every one of their members a copy of Jay Hughes's first book, Family Wealth. One of their members worked in Denver. He had come in contact with my client and, as a prospect, had basically given my client the book and said, here's a gift. This is what I'm all about. Read this. And so that eventually that individual who gave my client the book that results in my meeting Jay, he and Jay and I became a triumvirate in service to that family. And his name is Tim Belber, and he's now the chancellor of the Purposeful Planning Institute.
Maybe you could talk in some detail about how you worked with families at that point.
At that point, it was quite different. I was still very much at that stage just mired in the dotting of the I's and the crossing of the T's from the tax planning standpoint. I should give myself a little bit of credit that I was thoughtful enough to begin to try to get clients to think more holistically around the impact they wanted to have. But family meetings, opportunity grants, family banks, all of the ways in which structurally I would grow to try to help families get on this flourishing family pathway, I wasn't doing any of that. That basically, I was tutored for 5 years by Jay Hughes. And at the end of that 5 year period, Jay called me up and said, I'm going to be in Denver for the last family meeting. I'm coming a day early. Would you have lunch with me the day before? We had lunch, and I still remember vividly the hotel that we met in, and we're having this lunch. And Jay says, John A., you're going to leave the large law firm and you're going to do what I do. And I said, Jay, you're wrong. I'm going to stay in the large law firm and I am going to do what you do, but I'm going to do it inside the large law firm. And Jay said, my friend, you're sadly mistaken. You'll never be able to do this work inside of a large law firm. I tried it twice and failed. It can't be done. And that I left that lunch that day, Joe, bound and determined to prove Jay wrong. And for the next 18 months, so this would be into the fall of 08, I worked at it. I created a plan, a vision, presented it to the executive committee of the law firm, got their buy-in, started to recruit other significant lawyers and consultants that would subscribe to this and that would either come into the firm or enter into consulting agreements with our firm, that they would be available to help us serve families. And then the day before we were to have the giant kind of signing ceremony at a country club to start this, kick it all off, the managing partner of the firm came into my office and said, sorry, I've canceled our meeting tomorrow. And I said, you're going out of town? He said, no, we met this morning, the executive committee. We can no longer afford your grand plan. That's what he called it. And he says, you're going to have to go back and do things the same old way, the same old way. And that's the night I came home and told my wife, Jay was right. I'm not going to be able to do this. And she said, they told you to come back in 3 to 4 years that this is, just because of the current economic circumstances and the world today, but come back in 3 to 4 years, you don't have to leave. I said, sweetheart, if I don't start doing what Jay does, I'm going to die at my desk with my boots on. I was being a little bit dramatic. And that led to really another almost 2 years, not quite, struggle. And it wasn't a serious marital struggle, but we grew apart over this idea, with her becoming ever more convinced that I should stay and I growing impatient to leave. And at the end of that, there's a spiritual epiphany that occurred that changed her heart and led her to get behind me. And within 3 months after she got behind me, PPI was born. I left the large law firm and I've been on a totally different course ever since.
What is it specifically that prevents something like this from working in a large law firm?
I don't know that this is the only factor, but ultimately, in that kind of 3 or 4 month period that I announced to the firm that I was leaving, they didn't want me to leave. And so they began to try to see if they could negotiate a compromise that would allow me to stay. And so they wanted me to outline what I wanted to do and how I proposed doing it. And what it came down to was there were 5 members of the executive committee, one of whom was the firm's internal counsel, so general counsel inside the law firm. And that individual was really, her life was managed by the expectations of the professional liability insurer. And she was deeply concerned, Joe, that in my describing how I would serve, which was we were going to serve the entire family, not just the patriarch and matriarch. We wanted to basically look at the family as our client, and we would hold these family meetings and do things across the generations of a family. She became extremely concerned that the consulting side of what we were doing would get mixed into the legal side and would then result in malpractice claims. And that's ultimately what that fear, that a wealthy family would blow up because of the work that we were doing with them and then blame us for the blow up and sue us, that's ultimately what killed it.
So you and Tim Belber worked directly with Jay with clients. What is it like to be in the room with Jay? How does Jay handle these family meetings that was different from the practice that you were used to?
Quite different, and was never about the technical legal side. It was always about the family, exploring how the family could better make decisions, share opportunities, empower and encourage each other. The way we worked with Jay would always insist about a month, 6 weeks before the next family meeting, that Tim and I and Jay get together by phone, review what had happened in the earlier meeting. So we started out initially doing 2 meetings a year, so approximately every 6 months. After the first couple of meetings, our client insisted that we accelerate the pace. He was so excited with what he was seeing happen, the kind of transformation that was occurring both in his thinking and his wife's thinking, but also in kind of the maturation of their children and the children stepping up. He wanted to go faster. So we moved up to every 4 months, so 3 meetings a year. The last meeting had occurred, we'd review in this call what had happened. We would talk about where we were going, and we would think about where we thought the next step might come. And Jay would listen to us, but we listened deeply when Jay spoke. And it was a coalescence of ideas and suggestions. And then after that, Jay would speak to the client, and in a conversation with the client would lay out what we were thinking about. and fine-tune it, and then an agenda would be developed. And it always had some commonalities to it. They would always insist that the meeting would start with a dinner the night before the actual meeting. And that dinner would be devoid of any conversation about the agenda to follow. The meeting was going to be entirely social, family, fun. And then Jay also wanted to make sure that at the end of the family meeting, there would be a fun activity. So our meetings, and Jay was careful never to allow the meeting, and I've deviated from this rule and learned sadly that Jay's right about it. Jay would try to insist that the meetings, our client would want to push more and more into it because he was paying in a sense by the meeting. So if he could get 5 or 6 hours, that was better than just 4. But Jay really would hold the line. We would never go more than 5, 5.5 hours, and that would include the lunch break. So it would typically start like 3 hours in the morning, lunch, and 1.5 hours, 2 at most, into the afternoon. And then it would be followed by whatever the fun activity was. So we really religiously followed that pattern, and it worked extremely well. Jay, the other thing I would say that Jay was a master at is Jay is a master of collaboration. He does not, his ego is such that he realizes, as smart as he is, he doesn't have all the answers. And he's aware of the areas, but he always would turn to, and he frequently would bring others into the family meeting that would work with the family and take them further. So whether it was figuring out what learning styles were, whether it was working on intra-family communication, he would tap into other experts and bring them in. Obviously, that increased the cost to our client. Our client had to be persuaded to step up and support that. But I think the client began to realize that Jay's valuable. When Jay suggests that we think about inviting somebody else in, and it was good.
What do you think it was that was so compelling about what Jay was saying, either in the book or in person, that you hadn't been hearing elsewhere?
Always loved the wisdom of the Greeks and the classics. What I love about Jay is his ability to tap into that wisdom and apply it into current society and current times. And the other thing I loved about Jay was his never ending quench and thirst for science. He's very attuned to the non-empirical, but and loves the qualitative side of the world. But he also, I think, realizes we need to pay attention to what science is coming up with. And he introduced me to the concept of consilience, the E.O. Wilson concept, that when different domains of science touch each other, it's in that contact that amazing new things come out. And so he was always looking for consilience when two different branches of knowledge might come together, and then looking for the application. So it isn't just curiosity about science and research, it's application that drove it. And that the fact that it was application and usually very practical and could be brought down and applied within the family, that appealed greatly to me. And I think this particular family that I worked with, it landed very well with them.
So another small question, how is purposeful planning different from traditional planning?
It started out earliest roots, understand that Jay planted seeds in me that began to germinate, and they're coming out my ears and eyes and affecting how I thought, how I talked. So one of the earliest, as I was drinking the Kool-Aid and allowing it to be expressed in my professional life, not just through service to clients, but how I interacted with other professionals and trying to influence them to see this was a better way. The first major coming out nationally event for me was speaking at a meeting of the American College of Trust and Estate Council. And that was in 2007. So this is right towards the end of the five-year run with Jay. And I put a program together that had a lot of Jay, a lot of Covey, a lot of other stuff, but I was trying to stretch their minds around the possibilities of how we would serve our clients. And at that time, this was in part due to Covey, partly to Jay, but I called it value-centric planning. And the values-based estate planning movement was kicking and really going places at that time. And that the Fithians, who I mentioned earlier, had a lot of influence. Scott Fithian wrote the book Values-Based Estate Planning, and I think that came out in the late 90s, and it was getting a lot of tread. So that's where I started. But one day, I was working with a Jewish client, and I was describing how we could capture his voice, his vision, his values, and bring that into the estate planning documents, integrate that into the documents, and how that would transform the system, because the documents would be kind of full of positive emotional energy and his vision and dreams for how his wealth would influence his family. And his wife just loved it. But he said, "What do you call that?" And I said, "Value-centric planning." And he says, "That's not for me." He says, "I don't wear my values on my sleeve like those people in Colorado Springs," referring to the religious right. He said, "My values are here." He points to his heart and in his head, and he says, "That's not for me. My documents have to be pristine. In fact, when you finish with your draft, I'm going to have my corporate lawyer review it." So anyway, I start drafting for this client, and we go through 8 drafts, and this is time sensitive. He's got a major deal about to go down. We're trying to get ahead of the term sheet coming out. And so I remember a conversation with him, like it's 7:30 at night. I'm at my desk and he's in Boulder in his office. And he tells me basically that he wants to create a family bank. He doesn't use that word, but that's what he was describing. And I heard him explain the whys behind it and what he hoped it would do for his children. And so I redrafted that provision, I put that provision into the trust document, fired it off to him about 9 or 9:30 that night. And he calls me back and he says, "You did it." I said, I'll take it out. And he says, "No." He says, "Now that I understand what you meant by value centric, I like what you've done." And what I had done is at the beginning of this article introducing the family bank, I had put a text box in, and I had literally captured in about 50 or 75 words his voice, why, his vision for what he hoped this would do. And now that he could see it concretely, he liked it. He said, "Send me the document. I want the Word file. I'm going to go now that I know what you're talking about." I get the Word document back from him in 2 days. He's got like 17 other text boxes where he's put his own voice into the document. And then he gave it to his corporate lawyer to button up. But anyway, when he came in to sign it 3 days from that conversation, we're in the conference room. He says, "I never told you, other than I don't wear my values on my sleeve, never told you why I didn't want to go with what you were proposing." I said, "No, you did." He says, "Well, you've got to come up with a better name for this than value-centric." So it was with that background, like within a week, I'm on a plane to Cincinnati and I'm meeting Barb Culver, and we're driving from Cincinnati to Louisville. And we're going to speak for a half day at a program sponsored by the, whatever the name of this boys orphanage is. And on the way down, we're talking about value centric. And I tell her this story and I say, Barb, we've got to come up with a better name. Value centric turns off the Jewish community. And I've got a lot of Jewish clients. I can't afford not to have something that will appeal to them as well. She starts bouncing words off of me. And in somewhere between Louisville and Cincinnati, we landed on Purposeful. And so that happened like a year and a half before I left the large law firm. So when I founded the Purposeful Planning Institute, I knew it had to be purposeful planning. It was all about how could we transform the planning process to elevate, to put the values, the vision, the life wisdom front and center, rather than have them be buried, pushed aside completely by the sterility of the legal and financial planning processes.
How much do you think the advisor influences the family culture and vice versa?
Sadly, I think in most cases, not much at all in a positive sense. I think probably we could look at the structures that are being superimposed on these families and argue that these structures are antithetical. They're really going the wrong direction. They're not generative. They're not focused on empowering, encouraging growth. So I think that's the state of the industry. But the hope that we see is that there's a small group of advisors and consultants who increasingly realize that if they don't pay attention to the family system, and if they're not thinking systemically about how to serve this family, and they're not doing the qualitative work, they're doing a disservice. I think that the opportunity is increasing. I think families that have had experiences, positive experiences with people like Jay, they talk about this when they get together at family conferences and other families hear about it. I just had a conversation at the end of last week with a group of PPI members who are dealing with a family office in North Carolina where the matriarch has been greatly influenced by one of these books that's been written about a new way of doing things. And they want to figure out how do we do this. So I think the demand's growing. Jay always says it's more a supply problem than a demand problem. But I think it's both. I think we have to continue to talk about what the possibilities are. When families understand the positive possibilities, they'll begin demanding it from their advisors. And once the families begin demanding it, the advisors will quickly jump on the train. But right now, I'm encouraged by some things I see happening, and I think we could see it change pretty dramatically and accelerate rapidly. I hope we're at that cusp where that's happening, about to happen. But it's sad when I look back and realize over 20 years, we haven't made nearly as much progress as I thought we would have.
What did you learn from Joni Brontman?
Joni, I've learned a lot from Joni, one of the sweetest people I know. I think the two biggest things I would say that Joni's done for me is one, her and she, this is, I think, where she's had a huge influence with Jay, as well as her work on fiscal inequality in marriage and relationship. And second would be her deep commitment, passion for not letting the voices of the patriarchs be so thundering loud that we can't hear or give space to the voices of the rising generations of the family. Those would be her two great influences on me.
What have you learned from Gunther Weil?
Here's a man who, the only person I know who personally engaged with both Timothy O'Leary and Abraham Maslow. O'Leary was Gunther's, as I understand it, chair of his dissertation committee at Harvard. And Maslow was the first to hire Gunther. Gunther drew that association with Maslow, and I think even before he gets there, is already interested in values, becomes really one of the world's greatest experts in the area of values and virtues. And perhaps the most important thing, again, I'd say two things that I've learned from Gunther. One is that we can study and understand better what values are within a family and create kind of a picture of where the family stands, not just individually, but in a composite. And the other is the warning that I've heard from Gunther about the difference between, I think he calls them aspirational values, and then I've forgotten the actual term, but I'm going to say hard values. In Gunther's world, we aspire, we pay lip service to a lot of values, but really what we need to get drilled down deeper and discover is what are those kind of bedrock values that are really the deeper values that are influencing us, and that there is a difference between the two. And after he taught me that, I began to observe, yes, it's not that lip service was being paid to the aspirational values, but it was easy, popular to talk about this value or that value that maybe were trendy, but there would be disconnects between the conversations and the actions. And it was when I could see the deeper values, the more bedrock values that were the fuel for motivation and action, that I could really see what was going on within the family system on values.
Where do you come down on some popular models such as incentive trusts and spendthrift trusts?
Joe, your questions are amazing. I've come to a belief, and it probably isn't shared, may not be shared by Jay, I don't know. But I've come to a belief that we can have the benefits of spendthrift trusts, but do so in a way that doesn't rob, deprive the generative influence that we'd like the trust system to have. And that legal purpose, which has probably got to rank up there in the top three or four purposes cited for the creation of trust, the spendthrift trust, the asset protection side of planning, as popular as it is, I don't think it should be where we start. I think it should be a finishing touch that is added and is part of the plan, but isn't the driving force. And I think when asset protection is the only thing that is driving the plan or is the primary force driving the plan, I've sadly seen negativity come out of that. On the incentive trust front, I think that was a rage. I'm not seeing nearly as much there as we did 20 years ago. I think we can thank the Gallows and Jim Grubman for that. I think their 2010-2011 lecture at Heckerling, where they attacked incentive trusts head on and basically pointed out that psychology doesn't lend support to the fantasy that many parents had, that by creating these incentives, they would be able to have a long-term influence. I think they pointed out that the influence of an incentive trust is much likely to be shorter. And in fact, they suggested that it could boomerang. You could have the opposite effect creating an incentive trust. So I drank the Kool-Aid before I met Jay, but in my kind of post-Jay career, and then particularly since I got close to Grubman and John Gallo, was warned and heeded the warning, and have warned my clients that have come in wanting incentive trust that there are better approaches. And I'd like to think that a generative trust is really what those people want, if we can just get across to them the difference between a generative trust and an incentive trust.
In simplified terms, what would that be?
Generativity is that stage in the Eric Erickson model of human growth and development, where I think it's the next last stage, if I recall correctly, Jay would be able to absolutely nail. It's the seventh of the eight. That's where I think it is. But generativity is that stage that I entered when my first grandchild appeared on the scene. It's like a light went off. Boom. I felt this generative surge. It's generativity is the human impulses to nurture, to do good things for the next generation, to see myself, my life, in a sense, being extended through what the possibilities are in my children and grandchildren. A generative trust, to me, is a trust that's all about empowerment, encouragement, growth, development. It isn't a trust that is based on a restrictive, father knows best, we've got to protect these dumb kids who are going to blow it all. I've often thought it was humorous that we call something a trust that really should be labeled a distrust, because the parent or grandparent really doesn't trust that the goodness and the good nature of the beneficiaries will result in good things. Instead, we want to protect them from themselves and from anybody else that might lead them astray or harm them. Generative trusts are just the opposite of that, where we are encouraging them to bravely tackle life, and where we don't penalize them because they have a bad learning experience. Bad learning experiences hopefully can be turned into good, positive growth.
Thank you so much for joining us today, John A. Warnick, and sharing your wonderful insights with us.
Thank you, Joe. It's an honor to be able to speak about both Jay and others who've influenced me deeply, and thank you for leading the way on this project.
Thanks for listening. If you like the podcast, please share it with your friends and take a minute to leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We appreciate it.